So, this evening's talk, as usual, I come to Friday night with so many people about to listen to a talk, having no idea what I shall talk about until someone suggests something. And it's wonderful when people suggest something just beforehand, because that makes the talk relevant. And somebody who was just coming for the first few weeks to this center wanted to know about, you know, all this chanting and the bowing and all this other sort of stuff. Number one, what am I supposed to do? And number two, why? And so today we're going to be giving a talk on some of the rituals which we do here and why we do them. Because this is not just like a how to, you know, be a Buddhist or how to be sort of, you know, a really good Buddhist, and just at least on the outside, knowing all the rituals and stuff. Even though that sometimes I thought we could have some competitions, like a bowing competition, I was wondering. Or even, you know, we're having our opening up our retreat center on the 10th of April. It's my sort of, my character is always just to be a little bit on the edge. And so I thought we could actually raise a bit more money for our retreat center by having, we're having a procession from the monastery to the retreat center. It's only 1 kilometer. We're all walking from one place to another. But just to raise a bit of money, we could have the monks and nuns having a race and putting bets on actually who would win. We could give some of the senior monks, because of their age, a handicap. Just, you know, give them a few tens of meters start. And I'm sure you could raise a lot of money on making a book on who would win. But the rituals of Buddhism, it's so we can understand what we're supposed to do here. But the most important thing is why we do these things. For example, you know, why do we bow? And what's it really for? Because you see all these Buddhists bowing all the time. We're famous for our bowing. And the reason why Buddhists bow is because it exercises your tummy muscles and you don't get so fat. It didn't work for me. But it's not just exercising your tummy muscles. It's also just a way of paying respect to something. Because when you bow, your head's going down and that thing is above you. It's like, because physically, it's above you. It's actually a very deep-seated feeling of respecting. What you put higher than you, higher than your own head, is an object of worship and respect. So we do a bow to the Buddha statue, we do 3 bows sometimes. And people say, well, what do you actually bow for? What are you doing that for? It's putting yourself low, so that's high, so it's an act of respect. But you're not just respecting like a statue. Because that's just a lump of metal. It's got no sort of like spirit inside watching you and making sure you behave. It's just a metal statue, that's all. But it's what it represents. And that's what you bow to. What a Buddha statue represents for you. And to me, when I bow to a Buddha statue, I remember 3 things, and I bow to each one 3 times. And those 3 things, the lady who asked it earlier, I just was a bit tired and not clear. The 3 things I bow to are virtue, first of all, peace, and sometimes compassion, sometimes wisdom. I always join those 2 together. Because if you're wise, you're kind. If you're kind, you're wise. The 2 go together. So I bow 3 times to virtue, peace, wisdom, and compassion. Now why do I do that? Because when I bow first time to virtue, I'm saying I really worship. I think virtue, goodness, morality, not harming other people, not harming yourself is a really important thing in this world. So when I bow first time, I'm remembering the importance of like virtuous living, kind, harmless living. And when I do that, because I'm remembering it, it reinforces the virtuous practice in my life. And even as a monk, sometimes you can say silly things and harm somebody or harm some animal, even if you're not really intending to. Especially sometimes when it rains here, the back path can be a bit dark, and if you're not careful, you can tread on a snail and kill it. So even though it's unintentional, it's still a little bit of carelessness. So when I bow to virtue, I'm making sure that, you know, I'm going to be really careful not to harm beings in this world, and not to harm myself either by doing stupid things. So I bow to virtue, that's my first thing. And the second thing I bow to, it's just so easy to bow to peace. Because peace is just, I've had such a wonderful time in my life as a monk, having the peaceful moments, deep peaceful moments, and living in a peaceful place, like our monasteries. Even again, our retreat center, which I've been building. Now, when all the builders go, it's just a quiet place in the hills, just in Serpentine. There's a prison up the road, but there's hardly any cars pass by that road at night. And so it's such a quiet place, and peace is number one, so beautiful. It's obviously so therapeutic. Just giving yourself moments of peace heals so much illness of the body and so much pain in the heart. And sometimes just being peaceful. I remember just the building inspector of Serpentine Jarrodell Shire. When he retired, he was there for many years. When he retired, he came up to see me and said, "I thought I'd let you know that all these years I was working as a building inspector in this council, whenever I had stress in the office, I'd just get in my car and come to your monastery. I never told you about this. I'd just come and just park in the car park and just relax because the place was so peaceful." And I was so happy that he wasn't a Buddhist. All he did there was to come and worship the peace of the place and use it to heal the stress of his busy job. And that's actually what we worship, peace. And we also worship this beautiful thing called compassion and wisdom. Now, the kindness is so important in life, and you can never be kind enough. And last year in one of the calendars, I had one of my quotes, "How many times should you forgive someone who's hurt you, or cheated you, or deceived you? Always one more time." That's the kindness which is so beautiful in this life. Whenever you've had moments of cruelty or hurt, or it just makes life so mean and miserable and painful and dispiriting and discouraging. But every time you see an act of compassion and kindness, it just raises one's spirits, gives hope in life. It doesn't matter about economies going down or climate change, global warming. Yeah, those are depressing. But what to me is most depressing in life is when people aren't kind to each other. With all the difficulties and problems in life, just acts of kindness just add the beauty of life and make life worthwhile. I worship kindness, I worship compassion. That's when I bow down. I'm bowed down to compassion, remembering how important it is in my life, so that I can do more compassion. And of course, wisdom, understanding. And that's not a wisdom by being told what to believe. And that's not what wisdom means. Wisdom is finding out in your heart, in your experience of life, just what truth is, what happiness is, and what the right thing to do is. And so often when people come to ask me these questions about what they should do with a relationship, a job, or even big questions like, you know, abortions, a lot of time people know what to do. They feel it inside. They've got their inner wisdom. If they could only trust it and take away all the fear which we have because we believe what other people tell us, or even, you know, maybe suspect they may be right, this may be wrong, this may be terrible. So when we get rid of all that fear and we feel inside our heart, we know what's right. We know what's good. And that's actually the wisdom which every human being has. And my job as a teacher is not to actually to tell you what wisdom is, but to help you find your own wisdom and to encourage you to believe in that wisdom, the wisdom which you have in your own heart right now. And by encouraging you in that wisdom, you grow strong and independent of all these other ideas and opinions which float in the world about what's right and what's wrong, because you know it for yourself, and you feel it for yourself. And that's actually a person maturing, as they understand what wisdom is and they grow in wisdom. And wisdom is what protects you in life. And it stops you hurting yourself and hurting others. So when I bow to a Buddha statue, that's what I bow down to. Which means that every time I bow down, I remember those things. I'm mindful of them. I recall them. So they go stronger and stronger in my life. And that's what we mean by the worshipping of a Buddha statue. Again, it's only a lump of brass, or maybe of wood or stone. It's not a big thing. It's what it represents is most important. Which is why when people blow up Buddha statues, you know, we don't go to war when someone blows up a Buddha statue. What do we do when the Taliban blow up 2 Buddha statues? We made 100 more that week. So we came out in the end with a profit. And it doesn't matter. Sometimes people tell me, what about if you have... This was actually when I was in Indonesia, in Jakarta. They opened up a Buddha bar. It was like a franchise. This Buddha bar is a franchise which is for many countries in the world, which sells alcohol. It's like a pub. Only they called it Buddha bar, and for their decoration, they have Buddha statues everywhere. And so when I was in Indonesia a month ago, I said, what should we do? This is sacrilege. They're destroying Buddhism by having Buddha bars, you know, in Jakarta, and people going out there getting drunk, don't know what they do in front of the Buddha. And so what I was suggesting, because you might get on these aircraft and go on these overnight flights, they give you these little eye shades. So, well, go in there and put the eye shades over all the Buddha statues so I can't see what's going on. That's only just a joke. So say that if you get upset and angry about the Buddha bar, then you're destroying Buddhism. But just having a Buddha statue, even a pub or a bar, that doesn't destroy Buddhism. In fact, who knows, just seeing a peaceful person there, a peaceful representation, might remind some of those people in the bar not to drink too much. And maybe be a bit kinder to one another, a bit more peaceful to one another. Because that's what the symbol is. I don't know how many of you know this, but even the great statesman in the Second World War, Winston Churchill, had a Buddha statue by his bed every night during that war. The reason we found out this, that many of you know one of the monks who was here many years, Ajahn Nyanadhammo. He was visiting England one day, and he was supposed to be taken to a castle, but the castle was closed, and so his host didn't know what to do with him. And there was actually close by was the home of Winston Churchill, which was, I think, Chartwell. So let's go and see his home, which was like a museum now. And as soon as they went in the door and paid their money, there was a painting of a Buddha statue right at the entrance, apparently. It was a Burmese-style Buddha statue. So Ajahn Nyana said, what's this doing here? And it was actually painted by Winston Churchill. And the story was that that was a statue he had by his bedside throughout the Second World War to bring him a sense of peace in that very difficult, stressful time. And I know many people have Buddha statues in their gardens. And then, you know, they may have barbecues there, they may have parties and get drunk in there, who knows what they do in there. But at least they feel a bit of peace there. Once I went to give a talk at All Saints School, that's over in Riverton somewhere, Bull Creek somewhere, and after the talk, the principal said, oh, come and have a chat and have a cup of tea in my office. And as soon as I went into the office of this Christian school, there was a Buddha statue on this guy's desk. There was no crucifixes, there's no icons of Christianity there, just a Buddha statue on his desk. And I asked him, what have you got that there for? He said, because it brings me peace. You see, it's the symbol which that person was worshipping. And this is actually why we bow. Worship, there's nothing wrong with worship. The word means seeing worth in something, seeing something value in it. Worth-ship. That's what the English word means. So we bow to something because we find worth in it. It's something which can inspire us and encourage us in things like virtue, peace, wisdom and compassion. So that's why we bow. And if somebody bows and they try and get it over and done with as quick as possible so they can leave, Well, if they're just, you know, bowing there, not knowing what the hell they're doing, then that's not Buddhism at all. That's being stupid. And this is one of the nice things about the Buddhism which I learned. There was none of these rituals were there without a meaning. And you could ask, you know, your teacher or ask a monk, and they'd be able to explain it, why we do these things, what the purpose was. And that made the whole thing sort of interesting, meaningful, and the whole thing was like a practice which made you more mindful, more alert, more peaceful, more wise, more compassionate, more spiritual. It made you grow. So that's about bowing and the images of the Buddha, why we have so many Buddha statues all around, just to remind us of peacefulness. It would be great if we can have more of these. Last Saturday, I went to an opening of another temple in Cannington. It's great having more Buddhist statues with, you know, more temples around. And in my talk, which I gave a little talk, you know, I told all the politicians and mayors and stuff, you know, because their master had a dream. It was a Hong Kong temple, and their dream was having one of his temples here in Australia, and he made it in Perth. And so I said about my dream. I had a dream a long time ago that one day in the city of Perth we'll have more Buddhist temples than pubs. And I said, now I've got one temple closer to my dream. Now why do I say that? It's just so we can have more places of peace, more symbols of compassion, more places of wise virtue, not where you're forced to be virtuous, but it comes from within and just spreads out from you to other people. What a wonderful thing that would be in our city. So who knows, one day my dream may come true. I know Martin Luther had a dream. That's my dream. More temples and pubs in Perth. But we have these also, you know, before we came, monks came in here, we had some chanting. And people ask, now what do we do the chanting for? Now hopefully that, you know, if you do any chanting, you actually read what you're chanting. And you don't just say it just because it's a ritual. I know that perhaps of all the chants which Buddhists do, is that Tibetan chant, the Om Mani Padme Hum chant. And do you know what that means? And so many people chant it, I haven't got a clue what it means. It means, number one, oh, money, pay my home, please. That's the old joke. But do you know what it really means? Because sometimes people don't know what it means. And they just chant it, you know, just like sort of parrots, you know, stupid people. So when we have all the chants which we do here, please actually get the book so you know what you're chanting. And of course some of these chants we do in English, so people understand actually what they're supposed to be chanting. And those English chants are beautiful. They have like the Metta Sutta, just like a mother loves her only child. And will sacrifice the life for that child, fathers as well. And that's how we love other people, that's how we aspire. You know, to have this beautiful compassion. Just like you love your child, so you love your husband. Or your wife. Sometimes I wonder, this is really strange. I've noted this before. Your child, where does it come from? This being comes into your womb and out into your life. And you don't choose, maybe in a few years' time, you don't choose a gender, you don't know whether it's going to be intelligent or stupid, you don't know whether it's going to be, you know, really a good kid or a bad kid. It really is the biggest lottery of your life, having a child. And you're stuck with it forever. It comes from the previous lives, and those people who've had children, they've told me, when this person, this being comes out, it's not a new person. It's old. They feel it's got character. It's been around a long time. They feel it's a very, very mature being, but just in a new body, in a small, helpless body. It's come with character. It's come with the past. It has history. And there it is in your life. You don't choose it. You don't know what you get. But you will love that child unconditionally forever. That's your son, that's your daughter. And even if they're good, they're bad, with all their faults, you will always love them. Now, your partner in life, you actually choose them. And you actually do a lot of research before you commit. You check them out on many evenings, during the daytime as well. And these days, as I say, you always do a test drive many times before you put those rings on. And with all of that careful choice, in fact, you spend more time, more consideration choosing your partner than you do choosing your car. But why, with all of that careful choice, you can't love your partner unconditionally like you love your child? Why? It's fascinating. Just the love of our child is a different level, unconditional. The love to our partner is always, well, most people, with strings attached. However, if you stay together long enough, maybe those strings can be untied and loosened, and you can have that beautiful unconditional love. The same way you love your children, so you can love your partner. What a wonderful thing that would be. And that's why we chant, to remind ourselves of what real love is, so that we don't make too many mistakes in life. So the chanting is there as a message for us. Where the chanting started from is when, you know, we'd have these great teachings, and because the monks would not have, there weren't any books in those days, and because there were no CDs and iPods and internet, the only way you could access those things is remembering them. So the monks would actually remember them by chanting them again and again and again, so they became memorized word for word. And then that was their books, their memory. And that's where the chanting came from. And of course, some of those chantings, they did have power, because they had power to inspire. They had power to reveal the truth, and that's where they got the great energy. And these days, sometimes the chanting is just ritual. Sometimes I joke, there's going to be a marriage here tomorrow. When the people get married, we chant sometimes in party. They don't know what we're chanting. We could be chanting like the funeral chants during their marriage. We would do that, except by mistake. And they would, you wouldn't know at all, would you? But we never do that. But it's great if we understand what the chanting is. But it does have power, because it can inspire us. And a good example of that, some of the true stories of the power of chanting, was of this monk, a Thai monk, still alive. And he was visiting our monastery in California a few years ago. And one of the monks, one of my fellow monks, I grew up with him in Thailand, he told me this story. When he met this monk at the airport in San Francisco, there was two strange things. I know the person who asked me this story, she said she was an ANSET flight attendant before. She'd love this story. Because when he arrived at the airport, this monk's bag, you know, with the bags we have, the monk that was receiving him, the American monk, was fiddling with his bag. The zip was stuck. So as soon as this Thai monk came out of the airport, international flight from Thailand, San Francisco airport, he said, "Oh, you have something wrong with your zip?" He said, "Yeah, it's stuck." He said, "Oh, I can fix that." And he opened up his robe and took out a pair of pliers and a screwdriver. And he said, "Where do you get those from?" "Oh, just in my jacket underneath." He said, "Do you take that on the plane with you?" He said, "Yeah, of course." And he opened up. He had about three knives, two screwdrivers, big knives. He said, "How can you take that on an international flight? What about Homeland Security and all this?" He said, "It's very easy," he said. "Whenever I go through the scanner, I just meditate and it never goes off." But don't worry if you're flying, because only great monks can do that. Terrorists, no way they can do that. But also, you know, this receiving monk checked this monk's passport. And he couldn't believe that in this Thai forest monk's passport, there was a diplomatic visa to enter the United States for the rest of this monk's life, with no expiry date. And this American monk said, how on earth can you, just a simple Thai forest monk, get such a visa, diplomatic, for the rest of your life? And this Thai monk told the story. It was later checked out to be true. And of course he had a passport, a piece of paper in his passport to show it was a real visa. What had happened a few years previously in Houston, Texas, in the headquarters of the National Aeronautical and Space Agency, NASA, they were installing a new mainframe computer, costing many hundreds of millions of dollars. This was going to be the number crunch which ran the whole of NASA. When they'd installed it, they couldn't boot it up. They couldn't make it work. You know, your computer sometimes really gives you pain. But this was NASA. And every day, every hour, that computer was down, was costing them hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they got the best experts from throughout North America, flew them business class straight away to try and fix up the problem. But no one could fix the problem. They couldn't make it work. Now one of the engineers, one of the IT experts trying to fix it up, happened to be a Thai man. And he noted that we had all the best experts in the whole of the US from all the great universities, and they couldn't fix the problem. So he said, perhaps it can be supernatural. Perhaps there's something weird going on. He said, if it is, I know the very monk who could fix that, who was actually visiting the Thai temple in Houston at the time. So, you know, monks are very cheap. We don't have to fly business class or get fees. They just give you a cup of tea and a piece of chocolate and you do anything. So nothing to lose. They invited this monk into the mainframe computer room in NASA. And all he did was do a bit of chanting. And he sat in meditation. And after he came out of meditation, the computer worked perfectly. True story. And they were so impressed and so thankful that they used their connections to get this monk a diplomatic visa so he didn't have to have trouble with security for the rest of his life. Also, in case their computer failed, they can get him in quickly. That's like the power of chanting. Sometimes this chanting has got something powerful to it. And that's actually why, as Buddhist monks, I've told you this, we do actually lots of ghost busting. And it's really true, this is my experience and many other people's experience, if you have a ghost, the Buddhist chants work the most powerfully. Now we're the top, if you try the Christian priests, Muslims or whatever, Hindus, if it doesn't work, the Buddhist ones guarantee money back. There's all this. For example, just one of the great stories of the chief priest of Malaysia, Venerable Kesavi Dhammananda, who died not so long ago. And I was giving a talk at Ghosts at his temple once, and he told me this great story. One of the neighboring houses, I think it was a Christian person in the house. This was in Kuala Lumpur, just in brickfields, in the center, the Indian quarter of Kuala Lumpur. And there was a haunting, so a very bad ghost in there. So he went there and did some chanting. And the ghost disappeared, never bothered the house again. The trouble was, though, all the neighbors complained because the ghost had just gone next door. So he had to go, he said afterwards, he had to go to all these houses one by one to make sure the ghost went a long way away, not just next door. But one of the reasons, actually, the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery have also got very, very good ghost-busting chants. I know the reason why. The reason why, if you listen to us chant sometimes, our chanting is so bad that no self-respecting ghost can stand it. And they run a mile, oh, not those Bodhinyana monks chanting again, I can't stand this. But no, the real reason why we chant, that's just jokes about chanting, is again just to remind us of the teachings of the Buddha, because some of the chants we do, some of the ones I learn, when I chant, I know exactly what these chants mean, and they're really, really inspiring. And sometimes you chant and you pause for a while you reflect on these are teachings of the Buddha, and they're very, very deep. And they're very profound, and that's why sometimes I chant, I can cry when I chant, because they're just so inspiring. So when we do chanting, please don't chant unless you know what it means. Otherwise, you know, what are you doing it for? It's just empty ritual, and that's not what Buddhism is all about at all. So we do these chanting, you know, sometimes. I know sometimes that you see people actually lighting joss-sticks and actually lighting candles. We always have some joss-sticks or candles, and what are they for? We do those. This is a tradition of actually offering again worship with candles, incense, and sometimes flowers. Fair enough, you know, because you know the candles are always a symbol of wisdom, like light shows the way in the darkness. The incense was actually supposed to be purifying the place. Now, if you can imagine people maybe 2,500 years ago when they didn't have hot showers or soap or deodorant. You can imagine that incense, almost anything, would purify the air. So it's always considered to be like a purification. And also the flowers were also like a beautiful scent, a beautiful thing to offer to people. Just like, you know, you might offer, I hope, you know, flowers to, you know, your wife on sort of, on her birthday, you know, or to your girlfriend, you know, to sort of turn her on. And I remember just, you know, there's many times offering flowers to my girlfriends, but now people offer flowers to me. See, it's karma, that's how it works out. But the reason we offer flowers, beautiful gifts, it's just a gesture. But also we remember those flowers are just beautiful for a few days and they fade away. Just like us. The beauty of life. Now our youth, adolescence, when we're young, only beautiful for a while, and then we become ugly again. So just like flowers, right? That's just a way of things. Nothing can stop that. So we just use it as a reflection. But there's one time, and this is typical of Buddhism. This is straight from the word of the Buddha. At the end of the Buddha's life, he was saying all these people were offering him all these things like incense and flowers and stuff. He said, look, that's not how you really worship a Buddha, or you pay respect to a Buddha. He said the real way you worship a Buddha is practicing what he taught you to do, actually following those teachings. He said that's the best way you can pay worship to a Buddha, or to any teacher, or say to your parents. I know sometimes we say, do we really respect our parents? What does respecting your parent really mean anyway? It doesn't mean just giving them flowers and incense or giving them a birthday card, you know, or a Christmas card whenever, or Mother's Day or Father's Day, whatever. Because as a parent, what do you want of your children? What would make you most happy? It's obviously your child, you know, being peaceful and happy, a good kid, having a wonderful life. That's what makes you happy. And that's how we worship our parents or our teachers. By following their example, maybe following their tradition if we possibly can, or even doing better than what they did. So they're proud and happy with us. Now I'm a teacher, I've taught for many years. How can you say thank you to me? Just by being peaceful, happy, wonderful, virtuous people. And of course that makes me the happiest of all. I remember just, you know, all the monks I teach at Bodhinyana Monastery. Now they can say thank you, but the only way they can really say thank you is by being peaceful, good, wonderful monks. What I really enjoy as a teacher is seeing these little monks who you trained, you've ordained, growing up, and then when they give their first talk, and sometimes you listen to their talks, and nothing makes you happier as a senior monk than seeing one of your monks or nuns give their first talk and doing such a wonderful job. That really inspires me, makes me very happy. That's the way they pay respect to me. And that's what the Buddha was saying. How you respect another person, how you respect your husband, how you respect your wife, how you respect your parents or your friends, your teachers. You respect them by what you do and what you say and how you behave in such a way which brings them inspiration and happiness. So we have the candles and incense, but that's just the lower part of respect. The real respect is what you do and what you say and how you behave. And sometimes you do that out of love for your teacher or your parents. I just went to another funeral this afternoon. And one of the best funeral services, one of the memorable ones I went to, it was in Armidale a year or two ago. Ah, isn't that nice music? Background music to my talk. One of the wonderful things which I, funerals which I went to, a person I'd known for some time had died. I did a funeral for his wife, and now I did his funeral. And his children had had this family feud for years. And the two sisters had separated and never spoke to each other, phoned each other, sent any letters. Because it was their father's funeral, they came. And you could see at the beginning of the service, they were just very tense in each other's presence. They just had to go because it's Dad's funeral. But during the funeral service, you could see them soften. And after the softening, I did a ceremony, which is another Buddhist ceremony, the ceremony of forgiveness. And it was really just saying sorry to your father, you know, for anything which you've done by body, speech or mind, intentional or unintentional during his life. Because we've always got some unfinished business. But it touched their hearts, both of them. And they reconciled as well. And they came together and they said, thank you for that service and thank you for bringing us together. And said, don't thank me, thank your father. Because they did that out of respect for their dad. To actually to forgive the past and let go all of that terrible things which have separated two siblings and come together again. It's a wonderful thing to be part of, having a ceremony which had a meaning and had a positive effect afterwards. And what actually is that forgiveness ceremony? This used to be so common when I was in Thailand. We used to have the Thai New Year, which is coming up soon, April 13th, 14th and 15th, which is the same as a New Year in Sri Lanka, in Burma, in Laos. It's an Indian New Year. And at those days, where I lived in the northeast of Thailand, the husband and wife would always come together that day, and one of them would give a symbolic gift to the other and say to them, oh darling, if there's anything I've done in the past 12 months, by body, by speech or mind, a physical act or bad speech or even a thought which has hurt or offended you, caused you pain, I sincerely ask your forgiveness. If there's something I didn't do which I should have done, intentional or unintentional, I ask your forgiveness. And the partner forgives and says, now, if there's anything which I have done by body, speech and mind, or I didn't do, which I should have done, intentional or unintentional, which has hurt you or caused you pain, I ask your forgiveness too. And they do it with sincerity. And you always give forgiveness when it's requested. It's a beautiful ceremony which means at the end of every year we wipe the slate clean with all these stupid, silly things which we do, which we can keep too long inside of us to the point where it eats at our happiness and even at our health. And that was done once a year. And I've seen it even in monasteries, especially. I remember once seeing these two young monks having a fierce argument with each other. And I noticed the abbot never intervened. He let them go for it. And they were shouting at each other. And then the abbot said, okay, enough. Now ask forgiveness of each other. And they did it. It was a beautiful. Okay, they could let out steam. You know, just express, you know, some terrible thing which they felt about each other. Okay, now stop. And the two of them just asked forgiveness of one another. And it was done, it was real. They did actually say sorry, and they meant it. And so they went away afterwards as friends. That forgiveness is very, very powerful. Especially if you understand how powerful it is and do it with 100% truthfulness, with sincerity. It works. Just like many people, I just went to a talk last Tuesday in Curtin University. You know, Kevin Rudd's, sorry. It moved a lot of people. Simply because it had a ring of sincerity about it. That forgiveness ceremony is highly useful. We usually do it at funeral services if we've got time. Because I remember when my father died, I felt a little bit guilty. And the reason I felt guilty was I had an unfinished business. And the unfinished business was I was an adolescent. He died when I was 16. And I was an adolescent. And when you're an adolescent, a boy growing up, you're competing, you're fighting with your father. That's what boys do, to compete. And so the way I competed with my father, every time he put he didn't have CDs in those days, records, he loved Frank Sinatra. So he plays Frank Sinatra record. And on my record player, I played Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix was much louder than Frank Sinatra, so that I always win. And that was just a stupid, selfish thing which I did. And when he died, I felt so guilty about that because I couldn't say sorry. And only later on I learned as a monk, it doesn't matter if they've died, you can still say sorry. So I did a forgiveness ceremony, thinking of my father and saying, "Dad, whatever I've done by body, speech and mind, especially all those times I played Jimi Hendrix at full volume, I sincerely ask your forgiveness." And I can imagine what my father would say. "Of course, it doesn't matter, I understood what you were up to, it didn't matter." And the whole guilt disappeared. We've done that forgiveness ceremony, we say girls who've had abortions. Because sometimes there's a lot of pain left. And so you can come to this temple here if you like, maybe when no one's around, and just bow to the Buddha statue, to virtue, to peace, wisdom, compassion, and then say, "Whatever I've done by body, speech or mind, especially that abortion, I sincerely ask forgiveness." Can you imagine what the Buddha would say? "I understand. It's okay." And allow all that pain to melt away in the power of forgiveness. There's nothing terribly wrong with that. It's just what we make of it. And sometimes a forgiveness ceremony just lessens all of that. It abandons it. It lets it go. And that's why we do ceremonies and rituals. Because it makes the event much more powerful. It's okay to say let go, okay to say I forgive. But if you make a ceremony out of it, it's more effective and powerful. Same like marriage. Yeah, you can just say, "Okay, I'm going to live with you." But going through a ceremony in front of all your friends and relations makes it far more powerful. So that's some of the other ceremonies we do. Do we marriages as well? There's a marriage here tomorrow afternoon. If you want to see a Buddhist marriage, come tomorrow afternoon if you wish. And you'll find one of the things you see in a Buddhist marriage is we have holy water. And now we have holy water. It didn't start with Christianity. We started many of these things in Buddhism, but we forgot to get the patent before everyone else stole it. But it's a strange thing with holy water. Now, I usually only use it just on big occasions, like, you know, the Waisak ceremony or New Year's ceremony. If you come here, you know, see me sprinkling holy water over everybody. But you know, an interesting thing about holy water, and I couldn't believe this, you know, when I first found out, because I go traveling a lot. You know, actually, one day I actually read, you know, the form of, you know, what you're allowed to bring into Australia and what you're not allowed to bring in. And sometimes we don't even read that. But I read it one day and I couldn't believe. One of the things you are not allowed to bring into this country from overseas is holy water. It's true. You go and check someone who works in customs. You can't bring holy water into Australia. And I can understand why, until somebody told me this story. I'm not sure if this is the real reason, but it could explain it. Because there was this guy coming into Perth Airport a few years ago. And, you know, this was when, you know, they weren't checking, when he actually did have a green channel. Don't have a green channel anymore. But anyway, he went through the green channel, and, you know, the customs agents always checks a few people, you know, just on random. And he was one of the ones who got checked. So opened his suitcases. Now, reached underneath his, you know, jumpers and shirts, and under the bottom of his suitcase, two bottles of whiskey, which he didn't declare. So the customs man said, "Sir, what's this?" And thinking quickly, he said, "Look, I'm a Catholic. I've just been to the holy city of Lourdes in France. This is holy water. It's holy water from, you know, from France. Can I go?" Now, customs officials are not known to believe people that easily. So he said, "I'm going to open it up first of all." And he said, "First of all, look at the label. It's got Johnny Walker on the outside." And he said, "Well, you've got to put it in something. You just happen to have, you know, two empty bottles. I'll put it in there. Okay, can I go?" He said, "No." So let's open it up and smell it. And he opened it up and smelled it. And he gave it to this man. He said, "You smell it too. It's not water, it's whiskey." And the man smelled it and said, "My goodness, you're right. Another miracle." Which is why they don't allow holy water into Australia anymore. But we do sprinkle holy water on people. One of the reasons I do it, especially in a marriage, and Dennis knows this because I do, he's a marriage celebrant, is, you know, you've seen people getting married and the husband comes in a nice suit and the woman comes usually wearing white. It's actually another interesting thing. You know why a woman wears white at her wedding? Because white is a symbol of purity. It shows she's lived a very pure, chaste life. That's why she's supposed to wear white. So why does the groom always wear black? What does that signify of the behavior of men? But anyhow, she wears usually, and they keep doing this, they wear so much makeup, you know, when they have their wedding. And, you know, part of like being a Buddhist is being like truthful, being real. So during the marriage ceremony, I always give the woman especially lots and lots and lots of holy water until all the makeup starts washing out so you can find out who is really marrying. Actually, a young girl came to monastery a couple of days ago, and she told me her boyfriend has never seen her without makeup. Be careful, you guys. So once you're married, if you come to me, you know, you soon find out who you're marrying. But we do this holy water, but I make sure when we do holy water blessings, and I explain why. And they say the holy water's got four symbols to it. First of all, like the holy water is pure. You use water to wash your clothes, to wash your dishes, to wash your body. So it has a symbol of cleanness, purity. So say that this symbolizes the purity of your commitment and vows together. And it's like a symbol of virtue, clean living. Number two, water is always cool. That's why in the hot weather we go to the swimming pool, we go to the beach or to have a cool shower to cool off. So it's also a symbol of being very cool, so you don't get angry at each other. So that's why I sprinkle you to cool you down. And I say, if that husband, if he ever gets really cranky, just put a few drops of water on him. If he gets really mad, pour the whole bottle over him. Cool him down a bit. Same with her. So it's a symbol of coolness. And it's also the symbol of actually togetherness. Because have you noticed, if any of Australia gets very dry, the wind can blow all the soil away. But the water binds the earth together. The same way, if you know you're cooking something, making a pastry, you add water to the flour and the oil, and it binds it together. Symbolically, water has always been like a binding agent. It's a symbol of harmony and togetherness. So lastly, obviously, the water is a symbol of prosperity. Because with water, we have the crops, the trees, the flowers, the plants all grow. So water has those four symbols. Now, there's sort of purity, coolness, harmony, and prosperity. So I'm just reminding you of those things when we have the holy water. And that's why we do these things. It actually works. Actually, I'm just remembering when I went to that ceremony last Saturday, I also told the politicians there, because they had the politicians from the local community of Canning there. And then sometimes people wonder about having a Buddhist monastery in your midst. Now, is it really appropriate for some of these areas? There may be Christians there. And I get all this chatter, it's going to make so much noise. And I told them an interesting piece of scientific research, which I got from a journal some time ago. It was actually research which was done in Taiwan. In Taiwan, usually 8% of ducks lay an egg every day. And they can't lay an egg every day, but 8% of ducks will lay an egg once a day. When they played Buddhist chanting to these ducks, 10% laid an egg every day. So I told the mayor of Canning, he said, now you have a Buddhist temple here, your productivity will go up from 8% to 10%. Because the power of chanting. Or you'll actually have an extra egg. So sometimes be careful if you don't want to get pregnant, too much Buddhist chanting. It makes ducks lay more eggs. Be careful. Anyway, so we have these symbols, and this is actually why we use them. But remember, these are just symbols. It's the meaning which is most important. What does it contain? And the last story about the Buddhist rituals is why, if you don't do them, it doesn't really matter. You know, it's just why you do them matters more than if you do them. Even if you don't do the bow right, it doesn't matter. It's where you're coming from in your heart. That's always the most important thing. It's the meaning of it. And the last story, you know, which is a common story, or sorry, not common, I've said it many times before, it's a brilliant story though. It is why we didn't get upset when the Taliban blew up those Buddha statues. Why we don't get upset if we have Buddha statues in bars. Why we don't get upset if people don't bow or mess around in Buddhist temples. And it was a story when, a few years ago, in the newspapers, they were recording that a US soldier in Guantanamo Bay had been accused of flushing a copy of the Quran down the toilet. And because it was such big news throughout the whole world, I don't know if it was West Australian or the Australian newspaper, but somebody rang me at the monastery and they said they were doing a story about this event. And they were asking the leaders of all religions in Australia the same question. And he was asking me, Ajahn Brahm, as a Buddhist, what would you do if someone flushed a Buddhist holy book down the toilet? Would we protest? Would we have a demonstration? Would we be outside of Parliament with our placards and death to the people who flushed a Buddhist holy book down the toilet? Of course not. What I replied, I said, sir, if somebody flushed a Buddhist holy book down my toilet, I would call a plumber. That took the journalists aback, but I didn't see why no one else thought of that. Because, you know, you have to use the toilet afterwards. We're very practical as Buddhist monks. So that's what I would do. But then I got serious and I said, sir, you can flush as many Buddhist holy books as you like down the toilet. You could actually blow up as many Buddha statues as you want. You can burn the temples and you can kill the monks and the nuns. But I will never allow you to destroy Buddhism. I will never allow you to destroy peace, forgiveness, harmlessness, compassion. I said, I'll never allow you to flush that down the toilet. And I made this wonderful distinction between what I call the container and the contents. The Buddha statue, the temple, the books, the monks, the nuns, they're containers. It's what they represent, what's inside of them, the contents, the virtue, the peace, the compassion, the wisdom. That is what's really important. And that is what is behind all the rituals, all the ceremonies, all the bowing, all the chanting, all the everything else we do. It's the contents, not the container. It's not the books, but what's inside of them. What do those books say? to love the neighbor as thyself, and thou shalt not kill, to be kind, to forgive, to be merciful, to be gentle. So that's what we really remember whenever we do any ceremony. The contents. So if anybody ever, and if you're a devout Buddhist, and they tell jokes about Buddhism, and they try to upset you, remember, if you get angry, then they've destroyed Buddhism. But if you remember peace, forgiveness, kindness, gentleness, then they never destroy the contents which are most important. And all the rituals and all the ceremonies and everything else we do in this temple, our monasteries, we always remember the contents. So you can bow in weird ways, and I will never excommunicate you, but I'll say, wow, you've made my day. I've never seen anyone bow like that ever before. Thank you so much. That was made me laugh so much. Or whatever you do. So it's why you do it, where it's coming from. That's what's important. And if you understand that, you understand the source of all the rituals of Buddhism. It's what encourages virtue. What encourages peace. What encourages wisdom and compassion. What makes people grow, live more in peace, harmony, and togetherness and prosperity. That's the meaning of all these rituals. So I've already run out of time, should go longer, but that gives you an understanding of some of the rituals we do here, but most importantly, why they're done. So thank you for listening. Very good. So that's also why you put your hand up. Just a matter of respect. But why did you do that? So you do it beautifully with a sense of respect. Okay, so has anyone got any comments or questions about this evening's talk, about some of the rituals of Buddhism and why we do it, and more importantly, sort of where it comes from inside? Yes? Yeah. Yeah, it is true that sometimes it's difficult for people to forgive themselves, let alone forgive other people. And the first step of forgiveness is always to see there's something there worth forgiving. You're not all bad. There's a tiny little piece of you worth saving. A little itsy-bitsy piece of you which is good and kind and wonderful and joyful. And then once you start to see that, you see it's not itsy-bitsy anymore. It's huge. Amazing. There's a story in my book about the two bad bricks in the wall. Now, the reason why that's the first story there was because it is very deep and very powerful. Why is it? When I made a wall in Serpentine Monastery, two bricks were wrong. And I wanted to destroy that wall because of those two bad bricks. I couldn't get them out of my mind. Every time I saw the wall, it was those 240 bricks. It was only 3 months later, I'm just telling it quickly, when I was with somebody, they said, look at that wall, what a beautiful wall. And I said, are you blind? Can't you see those two bad bricks? He said, yes, but I can also see the 998 good bricks as well. That was the first time I could see anything other than my faults. And I realized the fellow was right, it was a good wall. I don't know how many people are like that. You had a difficult thing in your life, done one or two bad things, and that's all you see, the two bad bricks in your life. And what happens next? You want to destroy the wall. You just need somebody to say, there's other bricks in your wall. You're more than those mistakes. If you see the whole picture, you realize you are worth saving. You're worth something. And that means you can forgive. Allow those two bad bricks to be. So forgiveness starts when you realize it's something worthy of forgiving. No matter who your worst enemy is, whoever that worst enemy is, if you can see something in him which is beautiful and good, or her, which is really respectful, wonderful, then you can forgive. Once you see something worth forgiving. something other than the two or three bad bricks. Now some people ask me, well, what happens if you've got 998 bad bricks in that wall and only two good ones? I say, well, that's still worth forgiving. You can get in the Guinness Book of Records for that, the worst wall in the world. But two bad bricks is enough. Or sorry, two good bricks is enough to forgive. I work on that. So it's great psychology in why we can't forgive. You need to see something worthy of forgiving, first of all. And then the rest is easy. And then you're free. You don't have this terrible pain inside of yourself about thinking you're not worthy, or there's something wrong with you, or this anger and resentment at other people. That kills you. That tortures you. And you don't have to do it. Free, it's liberating. That's why we do forgiveness ceremonies, to try and encourage that. Any other question before we finish off?
Excuse me, Roger.
Yeah.
On Saturday morning, very often you'll see the Thai ladies holding the rice pot in it, but we're really not too sure what they're thinking at that time.
I don't know what they're thinking either, but what they should be thinking. Is that, you know, it's this beautiful food, and they're going to offer it to, you know, the sangha of monks or nuns. And this is almost like one of the symbols of Buddhism, the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And they're doing this as an act of charity. So the act of giving, they're worshipping giving, especially giving to worthy people. And that's why we do this. Celebrating charity. So the next time you get accosted on, say, Hay Street with someone ringing their tin, don't just put a dollar in the tin. Get that dollar, put it up at your head first of all, and then put it in the tin. You're worshipping goodness, charity. It's a wonderful thing to worship.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādeyi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi